Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, we don't have to tamper with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I am Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic, here as always with my guys. We're going to start out East. Freddie Katz, in a previous life, covered the Washington Wizards basketball team that used to play basketball. That doesn't happen these days. COVID has wreaked havoc on his team, and he's got so much time to talk about hoops and the entire league with us. Fred, what's up, buddy?
Hey, they played last night.
I gotta wake up. They did play.
Played a basketball game last night for the first time in 2 weeks, and I've got the least anticipated John Wall revenge game ever tomorrow night, which feels like it's just not even supposed to happen, considering how unbelievably strange this season has been. So
no fans in DC, correct?
No fans in DC.
And that game's in DC.
That game's in Houston, so there are sparse fans in Houston.
There's so many Wizards fans are going to be driving all the way to Houston to go, you know, support John.
It's really a Westbrook revenge game, right? I mean, yeah. Particularly with fans. Yeah. 4,000, I believe, they led in Houston, which...
Yeah, a Westbrook revenge game. He can get revenge on Steven Silas and Victor Oladipo and John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins and everybody else in Houston who he has absolutely no relationship
with. So much personal beef, yes. That other voice you hear is the one and only fellow West Coaster, Anthony Slater, Golden State Warriors beat writer. What's up, Slater? How you doing, brother?
I'm good. You know, we're just learned there might be an all-star game this year that I don't think any of us will go to. So
yes,
good.
ESPN reporting that Atlanta is in the works for the all-star game. I don't think we're going to go down that road too much today. Here's what we're doing today, gentlemen. Since Slater, you like to give me a hard time about how the normally West Coast centric Sam Amick is suddenly smitten with the Eastern Conference. I got to buck that kind of rep you're trying to put on me and make sure I get back to my West Coast roots. We are going deep on the Western Conference this week, trying to figure out what's real, what's not. And I know we've done that a little bit in past shows, but specifically it's like, all right, Lakers, Clippers, we know that they're dominant. We know that they're good. The rest of the top of the West is tricky to figure out, and we're going to make our way through there and, you know, and certainly hit on your team, Slater, on the bottom end of that. We are also going to introduce a new, somewhat temporary segment. This is in lieu of a more, you know, permanent segment that we'll create in the next couple of weeks. But the Brooklyn Nets, and see, it took about 3 minutes for me to get back to the Eastern Conference later.
The most obsessed Sacramento resident in history with the Eastern Conference, this guy.
Yes.
He talks about this Western Conference deep dive we're going to do, and then goes, and the Brooklyn Nets.
Teasing the listener. I'm trying to let them know what's coming. It's just the second part of the show after we give all this respect to the Western Conference. I am certainly focused on the Nets, what they're trying to build. You know, are they going to build? Is it going to break up? Is it, you know, how's it going to work? You know, so cutting the nets is the super not so clever name that I'm giving it for this week. And just trying to look at how Brooklyn's coming together with James Harden, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, Steve Nash, that whole crew. Last but certainly not least in terms of kind of big picture importance, because the pod is coming out this week on Tuesday, January 26th, sadly, tragically, the one-year anniversary of the helicopter crash in Calabasas, California. Kobe Bryant, his daughter Gianna, seven others who certainly should never be forgotten. And we'll talk a little bit on the back end, guys, about just reflections on covering Kobe and you know, kind of what took place a year ago. It's crazy that time flies, that it's already been a year. So let's go back to the top, Western Conference. We do talk so much about Lakers-Clippers, and with good reason. Those teams are compelling and interesting and very layered, and I can really never get enough of breaking them down. But I'm also fired up to talk about everybody who's, you know, trying to come at the king, so to speak, with LeBron James getting the championship last year.
Oh, I thought you meant the Sacramento Kings for a second. I was like, we're getting right.
They ain't coming at nobody. The Sacramento Kings are not coming at anybody, especially on the defensive end.
Everybody's coming at them, though.
Yes, they are indeed. They are indeed. I'm going to jump in with Utah, guys, because actually I think I'm going to, fingers crossed, have some reporting on Utah this week. I'm trying to connect with some of their more prominent core players and talk about how they've been playing. And, you know, and Mike Conley in particular, you know, Mike and I need to talk about how he somehow gets PS5s whenever he wants, but that's a non-basketball topic. But Utah is sitting here, make sure my info is accurate as I pull up the browser.
8 in a row as of our talk, and they blasted the Warriors the other night, which I sat through.
8 in a row. So I don't, is it 11 yeah. and 4?
12 and 4.
Yeah.
We're up to 12 and 4. 12 and 4. The shooting certainly is the, you know, if you're just looking at before and after trends that have changed, the shooting's incredible. You know, they are one of the best three-pointing shooting teams in the league. Bojan Bogdanovic is doing good things. Donovan Mitchell, you know, in spite of what Shaquille O'Neal might think, is taking his game to the higher level. You know, and Rudy Gobert, it's funny, Rudy across the board, his scoring's down. It's a different kind of year. I just think it speaks well of Utah's depth. You know, but you know, kind of how real do you feel like the Jazz are this time around, guys?
I think they're real. I mean, I think if you really want to look at before and after effects, it feels like this team gets off to a slow start on one side of the floor every year. Either the defense isn't quite as dominant as you know it can be, and then it picks up in the second half, or the offense kind of lags. And guys get a little bit better as the season goes on, and it doesn't quite pick up to the level that you think they might be able to. And they're on fire to start. And Sam, I think you hit on it. I mean, Mike Conley looks really good. He looks so much better than he did last year. He looks exactly like what Utah hoped they were getting when they made that trade for him. And the role players are just hitting everything. I mean, I think they have an offense that flows really well. You know, Gobert has a reputation of just being a defender, but he opens up so much with his screening and the way that guy and his kind of inside out verticality with the way that he rolls at the rim and gets defenders to collapse in on him. They spread the floor well. Joe Ingles remains just one of my favorite role players to watch because, you know, people say Steph Curry is so inspirational. I think Joe Ingles is so inspirational. I watch Joe Ingles and I'm like, that dude is a two-way Fred. Player. I think that dude he's a two-way player. He hits shots. He's a really good team defender. They're incredibly balanced. I think they're really good. I think right now they're pretty firmly, and I know it's not exactly bold considering they've won 8 in a row, but I think they're pretty firmly number 3 in the West right now.
Well, yeah, for sure as of now. 41 three-point attempts per game right now, which is third in the league. That's not what you think of the Utah Jazz, right? Go back a few seasons, they were under 30 three-point attempts per game, I think around like 29. So they just modernized the offense a lot more than other teams have. I watched that Warriors game the other day. It was 14-0 within like 3 minutes. It was one side who was shooting the ball really well, the Jazz, and the other side, the Warriors, aren't. The game started swish three-pointer, air ball on the one side, swish three-pointer, air ball, swish three-pointer. And it was 9-0 within 80 seconds. That was Royce O'Neal, very underrated. I mean, as we talk about building out the depth, Bogdanovich,
Jordan Clarkson, by the record, only Jordan out.
Sixth man of the year, probably to this point. You mentioned Conley. Now, some of it is unsustainable. They're shooting 41 three-point attempts per game and making over 40% of them. I mean, that will, you know, just historically.
Six more, I just looked up because to your points later, as far as the uptick and volume, it's six more a game just compared to last year. So obviously, Quinn Snyder and his staff, and Dennis Lindsay and Justin Zanuck in their front office, that group clearly decided it was time to you know, go kind of Houston Rockets style and take it to the next level from long range.
I think their starting lineup something like plus 100 during the win streak or something like that.
Yeah, and just
destroying teams.
Just to put in perspective exactly how much their style has really, really evolved, 47% of their shots are coming from three. They're basically taking half of their shots from three. And by the way, double shout out to Jordan Clarkson. That dude went from inefficient volume scorer to hyper efficient, really, really valuable off the bench guy. He has been, and it started last year. He had a really good year last year, and he's been even better this year. Yeah, I think he's probably the leader in the clubhouse for six man right now.
Double shout out as well to Joe Ingles, Fred Katz. I always shout out
Joe Ingles.
Well, I've gotten friendly with Joe over the last couple of years. And so, yeah, off the court, he's one of my favorite dudes. Multiple time visitor on the pod, which is not something a lot of players can say. So I enjoy Joe. Joe, though, if you were having a NBA-wide kind of power rankings of players who you want to roll to the low, again, non-COVID times, go to the local blacktop with and just go take people's money, like Joe's on that list. You know, he's not the smallest guy. He's a big guy. You know what I mean? But he looks so unassuming and so kind of like, you know, is he the guy who's cutting my lawn or is he the guy who's, you know, there to be a professional basketball player? He looks like a regular Joe, pun intended, and still doing his thing. The thing too, though, and let's go down this road a little bit with Utah, because it's a league-wide thing that I think, you know, probably doesn't get talked about enough.
Continuity?
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
yeah, you're reading my mind, Slater, because especially, by the way, again, league-wide, in a pandemic season where there's no time, where we're not really talking a lot about how there's no time as people really to connect with your teammates. And I've seen, I forget who it was the other day, who said that we need a team meeting. And they said, except that we're not really allowed to meet for more than 5 or 10 minutes and, you know, off the court in the same room. And that is the environment you're trying to compete in. Well, here come the Jazz with years and years with each other in terms of their core, getting through an incredibly challenging stretch last year where, listen, we wrote at The Athletic, you know, when I teamed up with Tony Jones and Shams Charania on a Jazz story about how close it appeared that they had come to breaking apart, and Donovan and Rudy in particular, that the friction that was created during that whole situation in March, it was a lot. And those guys both obviously got COVID at the time. So you come through all that, you lose in the playoffs, you know, and fall short of your own expectations and come out on the back end, you know, just kind of growing from it. I give them a ton of credit. And I think that continuity is huge.
And you know, yeah, what else is huge along with the continuity? They've been one of the healthiest teams in the league in a year where everybody's missing guys. I mean, we just saw the Clippers have some of their main guys out now with health and safety protocols. The Mavs have been missing. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about the Mavs at some point here because they're 8-8 and their offense is bogged down. But, like, they haven't had a significant portion of their rotation just because of the way the world is. And Utah, you know, knock on wood, Utah so far has been okay with that. There's no way to predict how anyone's going to be moving forward, but that's been really helpful for them.
Right.
They were the initial patient zero of the NBA too, right? We know the Gobert as which is crazy to think about back then when that Gobert situation happened, how it was like him getting it was like league shuts down, sports shuts down. Now it's like, you know, nine.
Guys, if you want to go back, and I've done this, if you want to go back and just kind of like, you know, not that anybody's looking to relive that time, but it's eerie. I guess this is shameless self-promotion, but I wrote a column the day before the season shut down that I still can't believe I wrote because it was all about how the NBA needs to avoid its patient zero. And it's just the crazy part is, and this is the sad part looking at just what's happened in the world since, is that it has, you know, the context in there of, okay, here's the state of the coronavirus in America worldwide. And it painted this picture of like, here's what the NBA needs to avoid. And obviously having no clue at the time that the next day everything would change and we would be going down this road that we've gone down. It feels like that was 3 years ago. But yeah, the Jazz get through all of that. And I mean, I remember being with them in the bubble during the playoffs and just marveling at how that, you know, everything we thought was going to happen in terms of the personal dynamics didn't happen. Donovan Mitchell was just crushed when they lost in the playoffs to Denver, you know, and this was one of the few things, well, I shouldn't say one of the few things I liked about the bubble, but one of my favorite parts is that because the media was, you know, there was a smaller group, right? There were just fewer media in the bubble. You almost had, like, in post-game, after losses, especially series-ending losses, you almost had this thing where it was as if you were covering a college team or a high school team, and you had kind of closer access to the real moments. And when the Jazz lost to Denver, Donovan, and obviously, you know, Jamal Murray and Donovan just going, you know, toe-to-toe all the way through that series, watching Donovan just be crushed by that loss was something else. I mean, he's in the corner. I remember talking to Johnny Bryant, you know, over by the Jazz locker room and hugging him for what felt like 15 minutes. And you just kind of saw that. Quinn Snyder was the same way. And you wondered coming out of it, you know, where's this group going? And they stuck together and now look like a team that, you know, like I think Steve Kerr said yesterday, you know, has the make and the look of a team that could actually push.
I think that was slightly a selfish Steve Kerr comment, because I think he was trying to basically explain why continuity has been such an issue for the Warriors. And he was explaining, like, look, you know, look at the Jazz.
Look at you, the Steve Kerr whisperer. I hear you, though. Yeah.
Well, trust me, there's some swirling stuff around the Warriors right now. The 8-8 Warriors. But, you know, it matters. And you know what else I think mattered? That Gobert extension preseason, right? I mean, like, I remember we did a Western Conference preview going in, and I think we called Utah and Portland kind of like the continuity bracket and how that would go into the season. And we talked about, well, you know, it can go two ways. Sometimes if you've been around each other too much and personal feelings are taking hold and contract situations are, you know, if you don't feel like you're valued by the franchise. And my big question was, do they get the Gobert extension done? They did. He's playing like his typical self. And then, I mean, Quinn Snyder too. I mean, probably at this point, we talked about Jordan Clarkson being in the sixth man of the year conversation. Quinn Snyder might be the early coach of the year too.
Yep, I would agree. Before we move on, and I may have shared this story on the pod before, but it's if I did, it's all right. I'll tell it again. One, I keep telling bubble memories, but one of my favorite bubble memories was Jazz related. That same night when they lose to Denver, we go back to where everybody's rooms are, and there was this one outdoor bar that was kind of the only spot where players and media would occasionally intersect. You know, they for the most part, we weren't allowed to go where they lived, and you know, and so we would stay in our space. But we were out at this outdoor bar writing with a bunch of scribes. And lo and behold, look up and here comes Joe Ingles. Here comes Rudy Gobert. They were leaving a post-game, you know, get together, not a party because they lost, but just a team gathering. And then I kind of looked through the window and I noticed that the Nuggets were in the same space. And that kind of struck me, like you wouldn't think you would hang out with the team that took you out. And without outing, you know, the rat of the group, had learned through certain means that the Jazz not only kind of did spend a little time with the Nuggets after that game, they made sure to leave a very substantial amount of adult beverages on the Nuggets tab on the way out. And they were very proud of themselves as they headed home for the night. And knowing that sometime soon thereafter, Nuggets GM Tim Conley was going to look at the receipt and think, good God, you know, you son of a, you know what? But they got through it, man. Like they're a fun group. We'll see if they can keep it up. Like you guys said, the 3-point shooting is gonna level out at some point here. But I do think Utah's got something going.
They've kind of vaulted Denver in a way, and it's interesting because they're connected in that series, right? I mean, and because Mike Conley shot rims out, right? I mean, remember that thing was halfway down, and the playoffs changed. Maybe the Clippers, you know, playoffs changed because they're the ones that end up losing to Denver. But I think going into the season, the thought was Jamal Murray's ready for the leap. And we kind of forgot in that same first round series, Donovan Mitchell averaged 36 points on 50% from the field, 50% from three.
Right.
He was equally as impressive as Jamal Murray. He just didn't get to go on and do it again in the second and third round. But I don't know if you want to flip the conversation kind of towards Denver, but Denver, you know, Utah beat Denver during this 8-game win streak, and Denver just hasn't, you know, been what I think the NBA world was waiting to see. That we probably all thought at this point in the season, they would be the team that we would be having this conversation about saying they're definitely.
Well, I mean, and Fred, I'll throw it to you, but real quick, since we talk about this a lot, we all know that like one of the analytical, you know, kind of tried and true measures of an elite team is anybody who's top five in offense and defense, you know, gets the kind of the blue check, so to speak. And the Jazz are fourth in defense right now and fifth in offense. They, you know, they get to check that box. Denver is obviously bringing it offensively with Nikola Jokic playing an MVP caliber, doing incredible things. Denver's third in offense, and then it's going to take me a minute to go down the list. On the defensive side, we are all the way down
20th.
Thank you, Slater. You got my back. So, you know, they lose Jeremy Grant to Detroit. We've talked about that a bit in the past, but I agree with you about that idea that, you know, for right now, it looks like the Jazz have kind of surpassed the Nuggets a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Nuggets are just going to have to outscore everybody. I think that's what it's going to be. I don't see them inching their way into the top 10 in defense, especially not, it's not just Jeremy Grant. Actually, one of the weird things about Jeremy Grant last year was if you look at the on-offs, they were really not in Grant's favor. It didn't match up with the eye test. It's not like when Grant was on the floor.
Killing my narrative. Well,
it's not like when Grant was on the floor, all of a sudden their defense was absolutely superb. I agree with you. Jeremy Grant's a really good defensive player. And we talked about him last week. He's been really good this year, and he would help them. But their issues are kind of beyond that. Torrey Craig not being there is not great for them. He is a very good defender. I'll never forget when I went to Thomas Satoransky before I filled out an all-defensive team 2 years ago and asked him what he thought of my all-defensive team. He asked me, "Do you think about putting Torrey Craig on there?" I was like, "Oh, he doesn't have the minutes. He's good, but he doesn't have the minutes." And Sato just ranted to me about how he doesn't care about the minutes. Torrey Craig is the best at defending off ball screens in the league and goes on an entire rant. I mean, he makes a difference, and Sato's a basketball nerd. A nerd.
This is when you know you cover a guy every day when you're dropping Sato.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. He is a basketball nerd, but you know, Torrey Craig makes a difference for them defensively too. And you know what? Michael Porter Jr., now that he's back, him playing more minutes is not exactly going to help them defensively either. But they're going to score like crazy.
Well, that's the answer, right? Michael Porter Jr. needs to become this star that they've held on belief that he could, right? I mean, every time you hear about these like trade potential packages, even with Harden's rumor, or any big star right now, even Bradley Beal, if we were to have a segment on that, we would probably talk Denver, and like, right, a Denver package would be based on Porter plus some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if Denver, to this point, who's been pretty unwilling to put Porter in any of these deals, for them to reach the next level, I mean, number one, yes, Jamal Murray must get back to maybe not bubble version, but better than the current version, more consistent. And then Michael Porter Jr. just has to become a two-way wing force, because you say Michael Porter Jr. won't help them defensively. That's a problem, right? I mean, like, because he has the physical tools to be a Jeremy Grant defensively, right? Like I don't think that's a concern. He's a 6'8", you know, bouncy, laterally quick, positionless guy. You could see him guarding 1 through 4 potentially. To me, if they're going to get into the Western Conference Elite, Michael Porter Jr. needs to become a two-way force. I don't know if he's going to. He hasn't really got the chance this season. Seems like he was in quarantine for like 3 weeks at least. But that's their answer to me.
I mean, he's just in the wrong place so much defensively. Sorry, Sam. Porter's just in the wrong place so much defensively. And I don't know. To me, the most amazing thing that scouts do is they look at a young guy who's not good yet at something, and they say, you know what? He's not good now at that skill, but he's going to be good in the future. So I don't know if 3 years from now, all of a sudden, Michael Porter is going to be a significantly improved positional defender. But at least for the present day, like, he's not there, and it sends their defense into misrotations and all that. And I think that hurts them.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Two things real briefly. Stream of consciousness side story that you just made me think of, but it made me happy and it is worth sharing. I talked to a scout today who will remain unnamed, and his team as well. But a scout who admittedly is on the older side, who got vaccinated and was very excited about the fact that, you know, like, he was getting closer to normalcy. And for me, it was kind of the first person within our world and our space where you started to kind of, you know, hear a real life tale like that. So that was a positive. That's a big thumbs up. And hopefully we can keep progressing on that front. But on the Nuggets thing, because we've talked about this in passing in the past, but I think we got to do a full stop for a minute to do the Jamal Murray bubble and bust kind of discussion. Slater's face is telling me all I need to know about my framing of it there. But like, Jamal was amazing in the bubble. I think Slater told me it wasn't going to last. And here are the numbers, as Bill Oram's texting me and distracting me. Here are the numbers. We have bubble Jamal Murray coming in at 26.5 points per game, 50%, 50.5 shooting overall, 45.3 from long range on 7.2 attempts, 4.8 rebounds, 6.6 assists, 2.8 turnovers. I know that's a lot of numbers, but you get the idea. Now, let me just give you the after really quick. Scoring down around 7 points, 19.5 points a game, 44% shooting. The accuracy from three is way down, 33.3% on 6.4 attempts, 4 rebounds, basically 4.5 assists. I mean, it's about a 35% decline in production. And efficiency.
So here's my Jamal Murray issue. He has a game this year. I'm looking at his game log of 9 points on 1 of 9 shooting, 13 points on 3 of 7 shooting at 32 minutes, 9 points on 4 of 9 in 29. And then 3 games ago, he had 5 points on 2 of 10 shooting. Superstars don't do that often. You know, superstars don't have 20 game stretches where 3 or 4 of the games are in single digits, and like, you know, they find their way even on bad nights into 18, and you know, they have little hot stretches here and there. And that's like pre-bubble, that was Jamal Murray, right? I could also read some games this season where he's had 35 and he's been awesome. The problem is hit and miss, hit and miss, hit and miss. That's always been Jamal Murray. In the bubble, he wasn't really that,
right?
You know,
he was 5-hour naps that we talked about last time.
Apparently
it's time to get some sleep.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, like at this point, we had an all-star, quick mention earlier. Is he an all-star guard? Is he even an all-star?
No, right now, no. Right now? No, yeah. There's too many good guards in the West. No.
In the bubble, as they emerged from the bubble, we were literally discussing him as like an all-NBA guard next season, right? He had played like it. Like there were times in the West Finals, he was like just as good as like LeBron.
Right.
For little stretches. Now, obviously, they didn't win the series. Or, you know, you go back into the Clippers series. Him or Jokic, you could argue. I don't know who was better in the series. And Jokic has held up his end.
He looks amazing.
Right? Jokic is, yeah. Yes, he's an every night superstar, even when maybe his shots off here or there. Like, the problem is Murray just disappears too much. That's probably how I would put it.
He does. You know, they're 20 points per 100 better with Jokic on the floor right now on offense.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Basically, when he's on the floor, they play statistically like the best offense of all time by far. And when he's off the floor, they play like the worst offense in the NBA by far. It is an unbelievable juxtaposition. He's been outrageous this year. He has a legitimate MVP case.
He does indeed. And it's interesting.
They need to win, though. They need to win.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. The MVP case is, it's going to certainly be tied to overall success like it is always. His physical work is impressive too, because it's if you go back to when people had questions about Jokic's size, it is kind of funny in hindsight how the Nuggets and certainly and people around him, you know, it was kind of like, you know, we were the crazy ones. Like, what are you talking about? He's fine. You guys make too big a deal out of it. And then you see, you know, what it looks like when he really dedicates himself, and he looks great. So he looks good. This next team, I think we're probably not going to spend a ton of time on, because circumstances have hit them pretty hard. And I just think they're going to very likely, start slipping in the standings a bit. Portland, which, you know, nobody, Slater's coming with something. I see you grabbing that mic.
No, I wasn't grabbing it. I was kind of leaning over towards it. Finish your point.
Damian Lillard, has kind of earned eternal confidence from everybody all the time. So that's just, I just think as an MVP caliber player, we know who Damian is, but CJ McCollum, you know, being out for an extended period of time, Yusuf Nurkic also out. I mean, this is unfortunately something we've seen before. They can't keep that core healthy, and they've been dealing with, you know, significant absences from their core guys for quite a while. And they were already, you know, kind of a middle of the pack team. So, you know, Dame can only do so much. I think it's going to be hard for them.
Yeah, I mean, as long as Nurkic and McCollum are back by middle to later in the season, you know, it's a broken wrist for Nurkic, it's a broken foot for McCollum. Neither of them sound season ending. But they were under 500 last year, and they went into the bubble like it really having to win almost every seeding game to even eke into the playoffs, right, into the play-in. And while that can create really fun Damian Lillard basketball, right, I'm sure it will in the next few weeks where we're going to turn on a random Thursday night game and it's going to be like, Lillard is trying to, you know, shoot his way past the Mavericks in Portland and he's got 48 in the third, and there'll be awesome regular season moments. They'll probably hover around 500 and he'll probably be a little gassed by playoff time if they make the playoffs because of injuries, because of circumstance. I do like their wing situation a bit more this year, but
Covington's been, he just hasn't been as impactful as I thought he would be. I still like that fit, and he's maybe one of those guys that where you don't see, you know, his true value until the postseason, but
not shooting.
They also can't defend, and they just lost in Nurkic. They're the guy who can make the biggest impact for them defensively, arguably. Right. I thought
Fred, Enes Kanter is their defensive.
There it is, the 6 degrees of OKC moment. 6 degrees
OKC. Fred, you don't believe in that?
I mean, Terry Stotts was
trying to sing that song the other day.
Nurkic is a good player. You know, one time when I was covering OKC,
did you cover OKC?
Speaking of awards voting, this would have been in 2017. I did not have a vote yet. Kanter asked me if I voted for him, and I said, "For what? Sixth Man of the Year?" He said, "No, man, best defensive player." So. There you go. There's your
smile,
guy.
Hopefully.
He smiled. He's Enes Kanter. He's always smiling. He's always making some joke, either at his expense or somebody else's. But right, that's a huge defensive downgrade for them. I mean, that's a bigger deal for them, I think, than losing Covington or losing Derek Jones. That's huge for them. And they already are serious. I mean, they're bottom five on defense right now. And I just don't see that getting better. I think they're going to hover around, you know, certainly in the bottom 10 defensively, especially with Nurkic out.
Covington's 27% from three right now, too.
Yeah. And Nurkic is mobile. He defends the rim. He's an underrated player. He's really important.
So, I mean, throwing darts at the board, where do they wind up in the West landscape here, you think?
Man, the West is crazy because you can already see it now. It's just so crunched. It's just a pileup. And I think the standings are going to kind of, you know, be like a traffic jam all the way really to the finish line, where two injuries like this to two of your biggest, most impactful players, like maybe they would have been a 5 seed. Now it's like I probably expect them to be in the play-in tournament. And they'll be a really fun, you know, they were really fun in the play-in last year with Memphis. So that's kind of where I see the direction of their season going, where it's just really fun Lillard moments, 500-ish record, and then they're just chasing at the end of the season.
You know what I really like about the play-in tournament? It really allows us to completely hedge all of our predictions. Now, back in the day, we used to have to say, yeah, you know, I think they're like the 7 or 8 seed. And now we can just say, yeah, I think they're the 7 to 10 seed. Maybe they'll make playoffs. Maybe they won't. It's totally fine. Well, so we can just hedge everything.
Good segue, because we got a lot of teams to get through and we're not going to spend all day on this topic, but since it's so muddled in the middle, I do wonder, this is the transitive property approach. The Rockets have their way, the new look Rockets, the Fred Katz, John Wall Rockets, have their way with the Dallas Mavericks on Saturday, 133-108. So clearly the Rockets are better than Luka Doncic and those Mavs. I mean, you look at, you know, and you guys can decide what direction you want to go, but let's grab one of those two teams. Houston won a couple games in a row. Who the hell knows? Maybe they figure something out. Christian Wood looks fantastic. And Slater's saying no.
You know who the star? That was a Sam Amick game, that Rockets-Mavericks game, because do you know what was the deciding factor? DeMarcus Cousins absolutely destroyed Willie Cauley-Stein in that game. That was Sacramento Kings center clashing. Cousins, who has done really nothing all year, suddenly came out and had 28-17.
He hasn't played that much. So, he had been coming off the bench. He's starting. I'm looking at here, 9 of 15.
He looks like the legs just aren't there. I mean, it's sad. I mean, he blew out a quad. He obviously had the Achilles. He had the ACL. I think it was just one of those temporary throwback games. I don't presume this is.
He didn't, you know, Colley Stein, let's not forget, that's the big who followed him in Sacramento. That's, you know.
I know. That's why I was, I was trying to rope some Sam.
I like that.
Because I was actually watching the.
Dude, DeMarcus doesn't. He does not need to worry. Willie did not make anybody forget about DeMarcus in his time in Sacramento.
Yeah. Okay. What I would say, though, is I think the Rockets are not a playoff team. I don't know if you two agree. I think the Mavericks are the more important team to discuss. They're more relevant in the conversation of the West this year. And the interesting, not only that loss, they are currently, I think, like the 18th best offense in the league. And we're talking about the number
Steven
one
Silas effect.
Maybe. Some of it's the three-point shooting, losing that. Porzingis obviously missed a big chunk. I don't know where you guys are at on Dallas, but like, for them to go to best offense of all time, efficiency wise, to literally bottom half of the league right now.
Yeah, I mean, Steven Silas, for any listeners who don't know, he was their offensive coordinator last year. So I'll give him a head nod in his departure to become Rockets head coach, you know, is something that matters. From there, you know, you just look at the fact that, and I'm cheating here again, I mean, Porzingis is only got six games under his belt. And so, you know, came back on January 13th. So we'll see, you know, if they can get the chemistry going. But certainly Dallas, you know, it'd be a shocker to see them anywhere lower than, I think, six or seven.
I find them so difficult to analyze. They've had so many guys out. I think they have five guys in health and safety protocols now. Four guys in health and safety protocols. They've been missing so much of the rotation.
So, Richardson was a tough absence.
Yeah. I mean, they've missed really important players. Dwight Powell and Kleba is really important for them. I mean, they have those guys and they win a couple more games and all of a sudden we're talking about a different team. To me, their biggest thing is I think they have to find a way to just be a little better in the non-Luka minutes. Because I know Luka has gotten his very, very, very mild share of flack this year for not being quite as in shape and not, I don't think he's been as good this year. I don't think anybody would argue he's been as good this year as he was last year.
He started very slow, but yeah, you know,
he's been good lately.
Right.
Yeah. He's really found a rhythm lately.
I got a question for you too.
What do you got?
I got a question for you too. So, I mean, if you have Luka Doncic over the next 5 years, like you should have title aspirations, right? I mean, we're talking about MVP candidate at the age of 22, 23. My question is, because if you're going to win a title, you need a really good number two. Do you think Kristaps Porzingis is a good enough number two for Dallas to win a title in the next 3 years? Or does he need to be a number, you know, do they need to get somebody better as a co-star?
Well, he's got to stay on the floor.
If he's
ultimately
on the floor and he's the player he can be, I think he's good enough. And it's funny, and we'll get to this after the West segment, but it almost, like the Brooklyn situation is yet again, kind of reconfirming some of my opinions about, and Slater, you covered those dynasty Warriors. And so I know that, you know, three All-Stars is great, four is even better, but there is still part of me that sees the complexities and the difficulties of making it work with three, you know, not even just All-Star, but elite players. I think Luka and Porzingis is enough if you have the right mix around them and you have the depth and you've got a dedication and the personnel on the defensive side to be dominant enough to, you know, to be, again, like at least a top 10 defense. I'm fine with that as your superstar pairing. Star pairing. Superstar is a little strong.
I think it's probably enough because Luka is that great, but you need the ideal roster and Porzingis needs to stay healthy, which so far we've consistently seen that he doesn't. So I think when you factor health into the conversation, you probably just need someone who's more reliable. Or you need Luka to kind of carry you through the regular season, then you need Porzingis to get, you know, really in his rhythm come playoff time, and then you're able to go on a run. I mean, they're also missing consequential defenders. I mean, you know, Dorian Finney-Smith was a guy I didn't mention. He hasn't played as much, and he's really helpful for them, and it hasn't been quite as great this year, too. So, like, I don't know. I just my opinion on them is that I'm still reserving my opinion on them. I feel like they're a team that could end up
going on a limb,
friend.
Is that the hot take of the week?
Yes.
There's literal limbs behind Slater's head in the Zoom call I'm looking at, and you're going out on one of them.
I feel like they're a team that in the second half of the year we're gonna, I say the second half as if we're more than 16 games into the season, but they're a team that in the second act of the year, whatever this their second act ends up being, if they put together a full roster, they can get hot. They can go on a run. The offense can start cooking. They've still been really awesome scoring when Luka's out there helping them score. So I'm not necessarily worried about them. I just don't fully know what their identity this year is yet.
All right. Executive decision time. And speak now or forever hold your peace if there's any teams you just have to get into, because I want to keep things moving here. But Slater, ever since he mentioned that there were things swirling with the Warriors, I've been looking at the West standings, just thinking, how quickly can we get down to Golden State? So we're going to go to the Warriors, and I will briefly skim over the fact that Memphis gets John Morant back. Exciting, fun. They've won a couple games recently. We'll see where they go. Phoenix, we should do a pod at some other point, really looking at Phoenix. They're interesting, but they're still middle of the pack, 8-7 as of this recording. The Spurs doing Spurs things and still winning games. Look at that. Now that takes
I'll tell you one thing on the Spurs. They've been way worse with Aldridge and DeRozan. And as we get to maybe podcast down the line for trade candidates, sure. I think Aldridge and DeRozan on expiring deals. And then I think the most disappointing team in the West to this point is the Pelicans. You know, they lost to the Wolves without Russell and Towns the other day. I think, what are they now, 5-10? Zion is not exploding like maybe we thought he would. The Steven Adams move is being questioned, 6 degrees of OKC, where his fit next to Zion. So that, to me, like, as we go down the list, like, I don't want to do a whole Pelican segment, but they're probably, I think they're...
Well, and it's uncomfortable, too. And I had this thought the other day, because anytime you hire a high-profile... pretty respected coach like they did in Stan Van Gundy, like it's a rare situation where you have all the expectations and really no chance whatsoever of, you know, anybody paying a price when it comes to the coach or even the GM. You know, Dave Griffin is building this thing. So we've learned countless times that when teams fall well short of expectations, there's a ripple effect of some sort. You know, something happens. It's either a trade or a firing. And I really don't know what it might be here, because I don't think they're going to give up on any of their young core pieces, and they're not going to change the head coach. They just got rolling with Stan, and Griff is new, and this is his show, you know, in every way out in New Orleans. So, I mean, I guess the only silver lining would be, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but without fans, you know, there's less people to disappoint given the current condition.
Wow.
But, you know, that's
his silver lining of the year.
You don't have to actually physically face the booze, but I think
it's all right, Sam. If you've been to a New Orleans game, it's not that much different from when the world's normal anyway.
Do you guys?
I actually think they're one of the teams with fans.
Right? Are they? Okay. So. I'm losing track. It's funny you say that, Fred. And this is a few years back. I'll never forget when Monty Williams, and certainly, you know, and his coaching chops have continued to be proven since then, but when Monty was in New Orleans, he had a terrible situation where some of those fans were so rough on him that they actually, they were booing his family. And there was some, you know, like some really uncomfortable things happening in games, but it never got reported, at least for quite some time, until Mark Spears, I think at the time with Yahoo Sports, now ESPN, Spears reported it after talking to Monty. But the takeaway was that, like, there was so few media there and just so, you know, so lightly attended in terms of interest level that things like that were happening, and they were just happening in a vacuum and never getting reported because of that Pelicans environment. So, that's a bad situation. Slater's trying to slow us down, Fred, on the Warriors talk, but I'm going to make him do it. You know, swirling is not an adjective that I take.
Swirling might have been strong. I'll just look. They're just,
what is happening with your team?
It's been a roller coaster. It's an odd. I don't know. Are they the only? I think they're the only team in the league doing this, where they are really trying to groom a lottery pick, a very important piece of their future. James Wiseman. You know, we could talk, is that to potentially package in a trade down the line, or as their starting center for the next 10 years, while also trying to win now at the end of a window of, you know, a franchise legend. Steph Curry, Draymond Green is within that. And their starting lineup, and again, they're going to play tonight. By the time people listen to it, maybe they have beaten the Wolves and they're 9-8. But going into this game, their starting lineup, which includes James Wiseman, is like -73. And they are by far the worst starting lineup in basketball. And, you know, some of that's Oubre. Oubre's getting a is shouldering some blame, but the reality is like they're just not very good with James Wiseman on the floor right now, which is understandable. He's a 19-year-old center. It's a very tough position to learn. But that's they've been really bad in those Curry minutes, and they can't be bad in those Curry minutes. And every game right now, unlike past years, matters to the Warriors as they muscle for seeding. And there's just like there's a portion of the fan base and organization that's like, you know, we need to really, you know, go for it now. Go for it this season, even if a title's not on the line, because you can't just waste another Steph Curry prime year. But there's also like, look, James Wiseman needs to play this amount of minutes, and this year doesn't. You know, you don't have Klay Thompson. The moment he tore his Achilles, title was out the window. You need to focus on the future. And it's this weird season where they've been winning two, losing two, winning two, losing two. And there's such a frenetic energy around a team, which I think the future is starting to look much better. But the present is in an odd place right now.
Right, right. Fred, does that qualify as swirling? What do you think?
Hey, I know swirling,
I'll just
my
say
friend.
This is what swirling. The fan base is irate with Steve Kerr.
Ah, interesting.
Just, fuming at him regularly. And like, I'm talking, yeah, I mean, it's tough because that's the online version, right? I'm not saying like every single, just like random, you know, a dad getting coffee that kind of watches the game and doesn't pay attention. But like, there's just, they've been calling for him to change the starting lineup and calling for him to do more Steph Curry pick and rolls. And it's just, it's interesting because we're talking about a three-time title winning coach and right. A guy with, you know, Eric Spoelstra level of security, right, in a franchise. And it's just, you know, it's interesting because the reality is if you wider scope, I think their future's looking good, but their present is just, it feels so frenetic. Sorry to rope you into that.
No, I like it.
Well,
I like
I'll tell
it.
You what. I cover the Wizards, so I can't at all relate to what it's like to have an all-star guard who the team, who is at the back end of whatever the heck this window is, who the team is trying to win with, while also trying to groom its first-round pick. I have absolutely no idea what that's like.
I'm going to let that sit.
I'm ready for your...
All right, let's talk Nets, baby. Let's go East.
The East Coast
let's go East. Cutting the Nets. You know, it's play on words. You guys like that? You cut them when you win, or we're going to cut them down if they lose. We'll see which direction it goes. If this was 10...
Sound like an East Coast. Hey. Sound like an East Coast guy saying that.
If I didn't give you context, and if I didn't tell you that Kyrie Irving, missed however about a week, I forget how many games... leaving for personal reasons. If I didn't tell you that James Harden didn't get traded until a little bit into the season, if I just told you this was a super team, so to speak, labeled a super team that was 10-8 in the early going, then it would bring flashes back to the Miami Heat experience where that kind of a record brought, you know, untold scrutiny and instability rather for Eric Spoelstra at the time, you know, and we know the story by now. It looked like Eric might actually get fired and seemed like some of the stars even wanted Eric out. And then Pat Riley kind of held firm and the rest is history. They win two championships. We're not there yet because the context matters and the Nets are just getting to know each other when it comes to having these three stars. But there is a little, to me, there is some, you know, counterintuitive stuff going on and some stuff that's worth at least looking at. For one, the whole three-star approach with these particular guys, I don't know. I can't wait to see how it evolved because James Harden in particular, I feel like every time I turn on a Nets game, all I hear, is their fantastic commentating crew highlighting the fact that James Harden, you know, took one shot in the first quarter. James Harden hasn't taken, I mean, he's not being an offensive aggressive player. And this is the best scorer in the league. No offense to Steph Curry, at least over the past couple of years, Steph's been hurt. James is the guy. James is the multiple time scoring champion. And he is in playmaking mode. He's being very unselfish. You know, Kevin Durant looking like an MVP candidate coming off that Achilles. There is good stuff happening. But to the general question of them three and the assumption of that they would be dominant so far is not panning out. And I know this is not necessarily the end all be all of analytics, but if you just take a peek at three-man lineups and you know, and just the best three-man lineups the Nets have, Durant, Harden, and Kyrie are coming in at a net rating of 5 and 63 combined minutes on the floor together. Brooklyn has 64 other three-man lineups that have played at least 20 minutes and that are better than those three. I just don't think that's what they had in mind, even at this early point.
They got swept by the Cavaliers in like one of those little mini series.
Right.
Right. And guess what? Jared Allen looked great.
Right.
For the Cavaliers. Right. That's my biggest issue with them is their front line. I mean, they traded away in this deal. They traded away their best center.
Right.
And they need to solve that. And you know, as far as the Harden stuff goes, it reminds me a little bit, Sam, you probably remember when Durant came to the Warriors and, Steph Curry, I remember all the way up until Christmas, that first season they played together. And then on Christmas where Steph Curry took like 9 shots or something like that. There was this weird, like Steph Curry almost overly deferring. And then eventually there was the conversation within, you know, from Durant, like, hey, dude, just remain Steph Curry. Don't worry about me. I'll get mine. And eventually they had a nice balance. I think what you're talking about is Harden just getting to a new team, getting to a new situation and not trying to be the ball dominant guy right away. But I do think once it matters, he will.
15.8 shots a game so far in 5 games for Harden. Durant for the season averaging 19.5, Kyrie 21. So about 5 to 6 fewer shots for James. And he's not shooting it very well, especially from long range. 8 attempts a game coming in at 32.5%.
I'm a Slater. I think they're going to go out and make personnel changes and bring in somebody who, at least one other player who is more defensive minded. Because, Sam, we started this talking about coaches. And ultimately, I don't know what the expectation can be of Steve Nash. I mean, I understand that often we look at how a team is performing defensively and we critique the coach because of that performance or we credit the coach because of that performance. But it's not like when I watch them, I think, oh, man, schematically, they're doing something horribly. They just don't really have defensive-minded personnel. I think that was one of the things that anybody said as soon as that trade was made. So I think there's got to be something else coming for them defensively. Because, like, it's not that they lost to the Cavs. To be fair, they don't have
defensive-minded coaching at the top either. They, you know, it ends up falling. You got Steve Nash and Mike D'Antoni. That's Ime Udoka and Jacques Vaughn. It's, you know, and Ime certainly got defensive chops. And I think he's fantastic. And Jacques certainly had proved himself, you know, previously with this squad. So that's where it's going to fall coaching wise, you know, Sean Marks, if you want to take it even, you know, higher up the totem pole, it's, you got a guy coming from San Antonio with a defensive fabric and kind of where he comes from. But yeah, I mean, the defense is an issue and I don't know where they're going to take it, you know, in terms of the lineup game so far, just looking here, their best 5-man group is KD, DeAndre Jordan, Kyrie. Oh, I'm sorry. Never mind. That one involves Dinwiddie, who's obviously on the shelf for a long time. The best 5-man group that is possible right now is Durant, Jeff Green, Jordan, Harden, and Joe Harris, 6.9 net rating. So, you know, again, early days, but interesting stuff. And then, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about Jokic and MVP and the team's got to win. I mean, Kevin Durant 100% has asserted himself as somebody who's on that short list in the MVP conversation, I think.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you just have a note on here that Durant's averaging 36.5 minutes a game, which is his most since he was in OKC. Right. He's coming off an Achilles. I think they're overburdening him. He's probably their best center now.
Right.
He's probably their best defender now. He's got to be their most efficient scorer. You mentioned the minute total. This guy's coming off an Achilles.
He was 25 years old the last time he played more minutes than this. You know, during the OKC days.
And we know him. He's probably like, yeah, that's fine. I will be the best center. I will be the best defender. I just don't think it's the...
It's weird. Not that this matters that much. I've heard some coaches and players talk about the COVID effect, meaning that all this sitting around, all this non-practicing, that, you know, there's been some justification for big minutes with, and not just with the Nets, but with other teams, with people saying, well, make sure you take into account, you know, we didn't do anything this day or that day because we were in quarantine or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's hard to really kind of assess all this stuff, but I don't think it's that complicated. The idea of Kevin playing that many minutes this early when you're trying to be a team that is there at the very end is questionable, but it's been out of necessity. So,
They've rested him too, Sam. Like they've had a few games where he's sat out altogether.
Is it more than one?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair.
Well, yeah, remember he had the he was in quarantine for a few games.
Yep.
I think he missed like three or four. So yeah, I mean, there's some of that, but problem is like I said, I think he, at this point in their best lineup, unless they get another center, Kevin Durant will probably be their center in the playoffs for large sections of games.
Right.
Will that win a title? I mean, he's about as good a stretch five as you could get. He can block shots, but I don't know. Their front court is just, it's just a problem.
We shall see. All right, gentlemen, before we go, and certainly on the heavier note, I do kind of wonder what thoughts you guys might have about, you know, just the reflections on the Kobe front. For me, briefly, you know, he was somebody who, you know, in terms of covering this league, if you go back to my early days covering the Kings at the Sacramento Bee at that time, and you both can relate, where you get very accustomed to seeing your team, and that becomes, it gets very normalized, whatever players and stars might be on that team. But when your early days covering the NBA and you're used to seeing some of these athletes on TV, there is that in between where you get a little bit starstruck by a guy. And Kobe was that kind of a figure for me. So I get in, and the first, you know, year covering the Kings, now you're seeing the Lakers four times a year, and you're making a point to go over to the Lakers locker room and just go be a part of a Kobe media scrum and try to get a sense of how he moves and what he has to say. And my first interaction with him, which was certainly a positive one, was kind of a cool story where I covered the Kings, and I wish I could remember the young man's name, but there was a Kings fan who one of his, somebody close with him had emailed me about something he was struggling with on the health front. And it was essentially kind of a, not formally a make-a-wish situation, but just something where a kid loved Kobe, happened to live in Sacramento, and was hoping that, you know, trying to see if I could help on this front. And I just thought, I have no idea if I can help, but it's not normally our place to facilitate these kinds of things, but just the human side of me kicked in, and I sent an email, you know, to one of his people at the time. And long story short, next thing you know, we're standing outside the Lakers locker room, and I kind of had made sure that young man who had gotten tickets through the Kings, they took care of him, and he's meeting Kobe Bryant. He's getting a signed pair of shoes, and you're just kind of seeing the softer side of Kobe, who at that time was still, you know, just reviled by most fan bases, and, you know, and kind of like the old Nike commercial, he was inspiring a lot of sports hate all over the globe. You know, and then by the end of my career, after he retires, just a very different experience. So ironically, as I sit here with my alma mater, Sacramento State, kind of my shirt on here, I remember a couple years ago, I taught a college course, standing in for a friend of mine who teaches at Sac State, Philip Reese, and who had me in to talk to his journalism students. And I had a scheduling conflict where I told Philip, I said, "Hey, I have a problem. I've secured a phone interview with Kobe during the same time that we're scheduled to have class." And to his credit, he's like, "Well, that's a pretty damn good mic drop. You should just tell the class you need to leave for a couple minutes to go talk to Kobe, and I'll take over during that time." So I take this interview, and Kobe and I were going to talk about his ESPN show, the, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on Detail, where he would break down film. And it spoke to the different place he was in life. So he's retired. And before we get into the interview, I'm telling Kobe about how, on a personal level, at that time, I was kind of pushing myself to speak to this college class and try to get better as a, you know, potentially an educator in my later years. And just it spoke to, you know, kind of personal evolution. It spoke to getting outside your comfort zone, all these things. And I just felt like, you know what, I'll share that with Kobe, and I bet you it lands. And sure enough, we just had this really cool conversation about, for him, you know, after his playing days were over, all the different things he was doing. And you see everything he got into. It's coaching kids at what was previously known as the Mamba Academy. You know, it's being close with his family and all these things. He had gotten, by all accounts, to a really neat place in life where he was more balanced than ever. And so in that regard, you know, the timing of his passing and certainly Gianna as well is just terrible. So it's crazy that it's been a year, but I don't know who wants to go next. I just wonder what sorts of memories or thoughts might you guys have?
Yeah, there's one Kobe story that I heard once that is my personal favorite that I've heard through the grapevine. And it probably stands out to me more just because I'm a writer, but we're all writers, so I'll tell it. One of my buddies worked at the Players Tribune years ago. And for those who don't know, with the Players Tribune, the players are not always writing those players. It's not like most players aren't like CJ McCollum sitting there with their typewriters and churning out journalistic stories. In a lot of cases, a player will call in, do a very in-depth interview. A ghostwriter will put together the story of what that player is writing, and then they'll put it under the player's byline and they'll release that story. And, this is outdated information by now. It might be outdated information, but at least at the time, my friend who worked at the Players Tribune told me this. He said that there was one player ever who sent in a story and said, "Don't edit it. Don't touch it. It is a perfect work of art. I don't want you changing a thing. Just run it." And it was Kobe when he sent in Dear Basketball.
Right.
And then of course that, goes on to be
Dear Basketball. Yeah,
exactly. Of course that goes on to be one of the most well-known and well-appreciated pieces the Players Tribune ever puts out. And he wins an Oscar for the digital short that he does from it. I never covered Kobe. I missed him. I was kind of just starting to cover the league when he ended up retiring, or at least I became a beat writer, that really what was his final season. But that to me just seemed like the ultimate Kobe thing. Such unbelievable confidence to be able to say, "Screw it. This is a perfect poem that I just wrote. I'm releasing it to the world so everyone can enjoy it. You writers don't edit me. It's not going to make it better." So I just thought that was like perfectly fitting of what the reputation that we always hear for Kobe is, of just the ultimate confidence guy. And clearly he was right.
Well, Fred, before we throw it to Slater, remember the documentary that Showtime did with Kobe, Muse? I don't know if you guys ever saw it. That's very similar to the Muse backstory, because they did the documentary for Muse and they interviewed all the relevant people. They got Phil Jackson, they got Jeannie Buss, they got, all the way down the line. A lot of people took time out of the day, and those are the principals, but I'm talking, just all kinds of folks, where it was going to have a lot of voices. It was going to be layered. It was going to, it was going to weave in and out. And they had the documentary ready to roll. And Kobe had been a major part of it, but they get to the finish line and they have their internal viewing and their internal screening. And Kobe doesn't like it. And he decides, I'm not feeling it. It's not me. And he scratches the entire thing, And he basically does the same thing he would do on a basketball court. And the director, Gautam Chopra, rolled with it and just was like, and I talked to him after the fact, and he admitted, like, "I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. Like, it was not easy," but he just decided, "I'm going to call it creative genius, and I'm going to just, give him the ball and let him do his thing, so to speak." And so then if you go back and watch Muse, that's the reason that Kobe ends up being the voice on that documentary for about 95%, of the film's length. And I honestly thought it was fantastic, but certainly was somebody who always grabbed the pen or the mic and did it his way.
Yeah, I covered his last road game. It was in Oklahoma City. I remember it was such a farewell tour, right? Remember that last season where the Lakers weren't good anymore?
Oh, it was very over the top. Yeah,
Byron Scott had basically been hired to like usher this farewell tour around the country. Right. He would hold these like massive either pregame or postgame press conferences like in these cities, and every media. I remember like I'd never seen an Oklahoma City media scrum so big, and they were all there for an opponent, which was odd. And I just like that season and the way that. I remember I covered his jersey retirement where they retired 8 and 24, and talking to all those Warriors at the time, David West, Andre Iguodala, Zaza Pachulia, Durant, down the list, Curry, Klay Thompson. They all had these like glowing stories about him, and you just never heard them talk about other opponents like that, which I, it just tells you what he meant at the time. And then, the day after he died, the Warriors were in Philadelphia, where he's from, Lower Merion, and I went to the first Kobe game after he died. Remember how every team was doing the tip, jump ball, and then they let the 24-second shot clock go off, and then the 8-second violation, and That was where I remember that night and just how Philadelphia, the city was mourning. I remember even going around, you know, pregame, you're going to get food. Like everybody was talking about it. It was such a worldwide event. I remember CNN was covering it and just, yeah, that was, it feels so, it's crazy. You know, we're talking on the 1 year anniversary. It feels so long ago because of everything else that happened in 2020 afterwards, but yeah, that was a wild couple days, really around the NBA.
No, it was honestly, it was an exhausting couple of weeks. I mean, I went to LA and covered it in terms of just kind of the aftermath and the first game back when they played Portland. I remember Damian Lillard went off in kind of true Kobe fashion. So it was a lot. Before we go, I always feel like, you know, I hate whenever I read the seven others. I just feel like it's, you know, I know we focus on Kobe because we cover basketball, but would be remiss if I didn't also name these just incredibly tragic losses. You know, it was Kobe and Gianna. It was Peyton Chester, Sarah Chester, Christina Mauser, John Altobelli, Carrie Altobelli, Alyssa Altobelli, and then the pilot, Arez Obayan. So rest in peace. Gentlemen, I know that's a somber note to finish on, but you know that we had to go down that road. Appreciate you and have a good week. We'll talk to you soon.